Nuketown Radioactive number 60 for Monday, January 7, 2008. Nuketown Radioactive finally returns as I wrap up National Novel Writing Month, figure out what it takes to get a TiVo around here, ramble on about boys in their trucks, spend some time playing Legend of Zelda Phantom Hourglass, and get caught up on a half dozen different podcasts. Well, folks, welcome to Nuketown Radioactive number 60. I am your host, Ken Newquist, and this is the occasional, or should I more realistically say, infrequent podcast about life, liberty, and the pursuit of geekdom. It has been a pretty long time since the last show, and I've got a pretty good reason for that. Actually, the last time around, I believe I was just beginning the National Novel Writing Month contest, which is this massive kind of marathon-like event for writers in which you attempt to write a novel in a month. And a novel is defined as 50,000 words. And I am very happy to say that I accomplished my goal. In the month of November, I wrote my book, which is, it came in at 53,000 words, or rather 53,379 words. And I've got to say, it's definitely one of the hardest things I've ever done. It was an amazing undertaking, and I'm very thankful to my wife and family for putting me up with me during the month of November and letting me write every night, usually about 2 to 3 hours a night for an entire month, which is just it's a heck of an undertaking. I mean, to put this in perspective, it was about 1,700 words a day. Except in reality, it was more than that because of a business trip I went on in November, and Thanksgiving, and just a couple of other things that come up. I didn't actually write every day, or I didn't write a lot every day. So some days I would have to make up for it by writing 3,000 words. I think there might have been one or two 4,000 word days in there, and it's amazing. I mean, I've written a lot of nonfiction in my life, but I have never, ever written anything this long in fiction format, and I'm really glad I did. So what's the novel about? Well, now that it's done, I guess I can tell everybody. It's basically about geek life. It was a merging of two ideas I've been thinking about for a long time. One was actually spawned many years ago when I was a reporter, and it was about kind of, the idea of being a reporter and what goes into that and working for a newspaper and kind of the craziness that is inherent to being a newspaper, or rather being at a newspaper. And over the years, that idea has kind of kicked around in the back of my brain. And when I sat down to write the novel, I'd also been thinking about kind of geek life. I think it might end up sounding a little bit boring, but, being a geek in the 21st century and hitting 30 and having kids and settling down and coming to terms with your own geekiness and coming to terms with yourself. These are all kind of themes that ran throughout the book. And it was a heck of an undertaking. I wrote this particular book rather than something, say, more genre, because I wanted to experiment with characters. I wanted to really write something that was character-driven, that was a lot of dialogue. And I think, ultimately, it worked. I can't say it was brilliant. I think there may be some really good bits in it, and I'm not really sure what's going to happen next with it. I think at some point I'll probably sit down and reread through it and decide if I want to do the arduous task of rewriting and editing and really fleshing out the draft of the novel. But in any case, I think it was a good undertaking because it proved, to me at least, that I could do it. It's one of those things that as a writer, deep down that you could do it, but you make a lot of excuses, right? And Yeah, well, maybe you don't know. I guess I didn't really know that I could do this. You think you could do it. You hope you can do it. But for one reason or another, it's really easy to put off the actual writing, the sitting down and knocking out the novel. And I think that's where the whole idea of NaNoWriMo, of a deadline, about really trying to accomplish this comes into play, and where it's really helpful. I mean, I am definitely the kind of writer, and this goes back to when I was, heck, high school, working for the student newspaper, or even just writing English papers. You know, I've always been a writer who is inspired by deadlines. And the harder the deadline, the more I'm inspired. So for me, NaNoWriMo was really just what it took to get it done. Now, I think it was pretty hard on everybody. It was definitely caused some stress around the house. There's a lot of people who are wondering exactly why the heck I was doing this, but I think it went really well. And I think the biggest thing about it for me, well, there were a couple big things about it for me, but the biggest was probably just returning kind of like to the writer mindset. Although I have done a lot of freelance stuff over the years, I am a programmer by day. I'm a web developer. I don't spend a huge amount of time writing now, and I certainly haven't worked every day at writing for, like 10 years, 15 years. So to get back behind the computer and to be putting down those kind of word counts again, and to really be putting myself into that creative mindset, it was just a heck of a thing. So I'm very happy to have done NaNoWriMo. And I think I would like to do this again. Now, I don't think I will do NaNoWriMo again, because honestly, writing this many words in 30 days is somewhat crazy. But I think I would like to kind of come up with a project again. I have another book in mind that I want to write, which is more genre-oriented, and I've been kicking it around in my brain for the last year or two. And I think what I'd like to do at some point later this year is, well, negotiate with Sue and find some time when I can sit down and write for about 3 months and say, my project for these 3 months, with occasional updates to Nuketown, will be this. And, set a deadline for myself, maybe June 30th, maybe start writing in April, finish up in June, something like that. And just really knock out another book. Take a little bit more time to do it. Do a little bit more research. I don't think you can ever have something like this that is truly relaxing, but spread it out a little bit more. I think one of the things that's really good about NaNoWriMo, and I think this is good for any kind of project that you might be doing, which you've been telling yourself you need to do it for a while, and you need kind of inspiration to do it, right? Well, one of the key things about NaNoWriMo is telling everybody you're doing it. You tell everyone, this month I'm going to write a novel. And then they kind of have to hold you to it. And when you're sitting there going, I don't know if I'm really going to finish this or if I really want to work tonight, you think about all the people you told that you're going to do this, and suddenly you find the inspiration to actually do it. So I think that approach and a self-imposed deadline and blogging on Nuketown and blogging over at the Dyer Cafe will do a lot to accomplish the same thing outside of NaNoWriMo. So look for that later this year. Now, I gotta say, one of the downsides to NaNoWriMo was that it really got me out of the podcasting mindset. I had really been, doing well. I think as the fall went on, I had done a better job at getting podcasts out on a somewhat regular basis. But as soon as NaNoWriMo came around, it pretty much sucked up all my time. But there were also other things sucking up all of my time, like two game reviews that I had to write for sci-fi.com, which fell, unfortunately, in November. I had actually planned to review these much earlier. The release dates for the games were in the early fall, but it just so happened that they both came out within, like, I think a week of one another. The games in question are Mass Effect, which I gave an A minus, and BlackSight: Area 51, which I gave a C. There'll be links to both of those in the show notes. And the quick thumbnail reviews are Mass Effect is pretty cool. It has some minor flaws to it in terms of the interface, I think is probably the biggest drawback, especially managing inventory. But I really like this game. It looks beautiful, even on a crappy old TV like mine, and it just feels really immersive. It's definitely the kind of game that you play for just hours and hours on end. And if you liked Knights of the Old Republic or Knights of the Old Republic 2, this game is by BioWare, so you will truly enjoy this game if you liked either one of those. I will say, aside from the little interface things, the one thing that kind of threw me about this game was the classes. Basically, when it comes right down to it, let me back up for a second. You can play a couple different classes in this game. You can play a soldier, you can play, I think it's like an assassin, basically an espionage kind of guy. You can play an engineer, you can play a, the name escapes me, basically a psionic, the person who can use their magic abilities, that kind of thing. And when it comes right down to it, really, the only one that you really want to play is Soldier, because it gives you access to all the weapons, and then all the magical, well, not really magic, it's the Mass Effect-based abilities, but for lack of a better term, magic abilities in the game are accessed through other characters. And since you can control the other characters in your squad, at least indirectly through the various pop-up menus, there's no real reason to play one of the other classes. The other thing that's kind of a drawback in this game, especially with the multiple classes, is that you can't directly take control of other characters like you could in Knights of the Old Republic. So this isn't something that really, I guess when I first started playing it, it didn't bother me as much, but now that I've been around the block a couple of times and I've been playing the game for a bunch of hours, I think it's really starting to bug me that I can't play the engineer character and have my character be able to do all these abilities and then quickly switch to the soldier when I need to do battles like I could have in Knights of the Old Republic. With this, you're pretty much stuck with your own character, and while you can access most of the other abilities for the other characters, you can't actually directly take control of them and then, say, use your assassin-type character to, you know, take out somebody with a sniper shot. So that's annoying, and I'm certainly hoping that they'll address that in episode 2. This is supposed to be a trilogy, so one hopes that we will see improvements like that. But overall, it's just it's a really nice game. Way open-ended. It looks to be just like an awesome game when you want to sit down and explore a galaxy. Now, I know not all of us have time to sit down and explore a galaxy, but it is just a beautiful game to play, so I do recommend it. The other game was Blacksite Area 51. This was a sequel to a rather mediocre shooter from the 90s called Blacksite, or called Area 51. And in theory, this is kind of inspired by the old arcade game, but honestly, Midway has stripped out anything that would have been interesting or appealing from the arcade game and just made it into pretty much a straightforward, conventional first-person shooter. You're up against aliens. If you've played Half-Life, you've played Halo, you've pretty much seen everything that you'll see in this game. A lot of the monsters from those games are tweaked and recycled here. There's some cool things, like being able to fight from a gunship was pretty cool. Some of the original art and the original monsters were interesting, but ultimately, when it comes right down to it, and can I throw too many more cliches in there? But in the end, the game just didn't do very much for me, especially since, you know, I had Halo 3 still sitting around waiting to be played again, and knowing that the orange box, aka Half-Life 2, was probably going to be showing up underneath my geek tree for Christmas, it just wasn't a particularly compelling game, so I can't really recommend it that much. It's okay, it's mediocre, but there's plenty of other things out there that you could play instead of this. So in the last 6 weeks or so, Luke has been growing amazingly, just maturing across the board, and he's talking a lot more, he's much more stable on his feet, he's playing with his sister in just entirely different ways, which is really cool. They've moved beyond the Luke's the baby and Jordan's the big sister. Now it's much more interaction between the two. Luke isn't quite able to talk in sentences most of the time. He has a couple phrases he likes, like truck go, or truck go vroom. Mostly sentences involving trucks, but we'll get into that in a second. But, you know, they're able to really play with one another, and Jordan will pile up pillows in the middle of the library, and they'll just kind of play King of the Mountain on that. And they'll just wrestle and play with little people or whatever. And it's cool to see them kind of going from Luke's just this baby who Jordan was certainly always affectionate towards and loves, but, you know, she was doing stuff to him less than doing stuff with him, you know? So now they're actually interacting with one another as brother and sister, and that's been just really, really cool to see. The other thing that's kind of interesting is Luke is just completely and utterly obsessed with trucks. Now, I have certainly heard about this phenomenon from other parents who have boys, but this kid loves his trucks. we didn't have a lot of trucks with Jordan. She just didn't show much interest in them. She had a bunch of Matchbox cars, and she liked to play with them occasionally, but not the way that Luke does. I mean, Luke, we got him a bunch of trucks for Christmas, including some more Matchbox cars and some Tonka stuff. And we have this great picture of him holding like three cars on Christmas morning, and he just loves it. I mean, he's kind of got this look that's just saying, these are my cars, go find your own. He likes to drive them around. He started making engine noises. He started like stacking them on top of one another. He hasn't started doing the demolition derby yet, but I can only assume that we'll be seeing that in the next couple of months, because I know that was certainly one of my favorite games as a boy. So it's just, it's really fun to see him play with this. I mean, he certainly plays with other toys. He likes to play with baby dolls. He likes to play with Puppy, which is this kind of like blanket with the head of a dog and feet of a dog. It may sound a little weird, but trust me, it's one of his favorite things. He's really interested in babies right now. He just learned how to say baby, so he walks around calling everything baby and picking up the the baby dolls and, you know, talking to them and pointing out their eyes and their ears and stuff. So he certainly likes his other toys, but when it comes right down to it, he just absolutely loves trucks. And I don't know, it's just fun. I think I can't wait until he gets older and we can start doing things like having truck races around the house and, you know, building trucks out of Legos and having demolition derbies with them. I think we're going to have a lot of fun with it. And it's just cool to see him going from being, again, you know, like a 12-month-old baby to, you know, 6 months later, he's on the verge of toddlerdom and he's starting to speak and he's starting to develop these interests. And it's just a fascinating process to watch. And I love doing it with Jordan, and I love seeing it with Luke too. Now, speaking of Jordan, it turns out we finally have a good reason to get a TiVo. Or rather, been told, what will get a TiVo into our house. And it's this. Jordan, for a couple of weeks, was just having really bad nightmares almost every night. I think through November into early December, probably most of December, she was just up every other night with nightmares. And it was really starting to grind us down. I mean, those of you who have kids or you know, have ever had any stretch of time where you don't sleep much, it really starts to wear on you after about the first week, and it was really starting to wear us down to the point where Sue actually thought, well, you know, one of the reasons why she might be having these nightmares is the commercials, because we'll be watching normal TV, you know, like Mythbusters or a cooking show or something like that, something fairly innocuous. I mean, Mythbusters isn't always that innocuous, and obviously their demographic is more action film / horror film goer oriented. But anyway, you know, she'll be watching a cooking show or she'll be watching cartoons or something like that, and there'll just be a commercial that'll come on that'll just, you know, be completely inappropriate for 4-year-olds. And you know, another good example, watching football, suddenly there's an R-rated horror flick that comes on, and you know, you got to think, she certainly has, she doesn't like monsters. She doesn't like scary things at all. This is definitely a key aspect of her personality. Our next door neighbor loves like Scooby-Doo. I think Jordan would never actually make it through an episode of Scooby-Doo because it would be much, much too scary. So we have all these kind of like horror-ish elements that show up on TV, and we don't have a really good way to skip past them because, hey, we don't have a TiVo. But, folks, that's when Sue struck upon the revelation that, well, if we had a TiVo, we could record the stuff that Jordy's likely to watch and then just skip past the commercials. So, hey, who am I to argue with progress, right? So my friend Courtney had a refurbished TiVo that she didn't need anymore because she had just upgraded her DirecTV set to have an HD DVR type thing. So she wanted to know if I wanted the TiVo. So I said, well, let's try it out. So we've been trying it out, and for the most part, it seems to be working okay. I had a couple of issues early on where I set it to record Crypto the Superdog, which is Jordan's favorite cartoon show, and unfortunately, it went mad and decided to record every freaking cartoon on television based on that one data point, which is what TiVo does, right? It records suggestions based on what it thinks you want. So I turned that off. The other challenge with it is the remote's a little slow. The interface is a little bit wonky. You can only you can't watch a different channel and record at the same time, which threw Sue for a loop. So I think I don't know. I don't know if the TiVo will be long for the house. I'm looking at getting the DVR through our cable company, which does have a dual tuner, so you can watch something else and record at the same time, which would solve that problem for Sue. And the other thing that I'm looking into for the cable company is they have video on demand. They have free video on demand for things like Discovery Channel and the Learning Channel and that kind of stuff. So I'm thinking that between the DVR through the cable company and then video on demand, that might satisfy all of Sue's video needs, because one of Sue's complaints was that the DVR doesn't really do her any good because, well, it'll be downstairs, and if she's likely to be able to watch TV, it will be on the third floor when she's working on her crafts or paying bills or something like that. So if it's recorded downstairs, she can't very easily watch it upstairs. But if we can get the video on demand thing figured out, then, well, that solves that problem because she can just do that upstairs. So ultimately, I think the DVR experiment has been successful because, for example, I was able to watch football today and record the Giants game and skip past all of the troubling commercials while Jordy was watching the game with me. And from that standpoint, it was very successful. TiVo itself is, I'm okay with the interface, but I mean, it's a little bit clunky here and there, but ultimately I think it's pretty nifty, but I need to keep peace in the house, so I think we're going to have to be looking at the cable company solution. On the work front, there's been a kind of cool development. At the college, we've been talking about Second Life for probably about a year. I've given two brown bag presentations on it where people came and had lunch and got to go on a tour of Second Life. And now all of a sudden we have a couple faculty who are actually interested in Second Life, want to take their classes into Second Life, want to go see the sites, and I find myself at a loss for destinations. I also find myself at a loss for a cool-looking avatar, since my avatar is still wearing blue jeans and he's wearing a black t-shirt. I was able to manage to change that. So if you folks have suggestions on destinations in Second Life, if you have ideas on how I can spruce up my character, spruce up my character on the cheap, because I'm not planning on having a paid account in Second Life, I'd love to have your suggestions. You can send them to me at nuketown@gmail.com. Finally, after months of languishing on my bookshelf, my Nintendo DS has a breath of new life. And that is because Legend of Zelda: The Phantom Hourglass was finally released. This is the Zelda game just for the DS. And truth be told, this is the reason why I bought my DS in the first place all those many years ago. Oh yes, I did want to try out new games, and I really wanted to experiment with the new interface, but really when it came right down to it, I wanted Zelda. And now it's finally here, and I'm really liking it. It's got some pretty cool little interfaces to it. You can, for example, when you throw your boomerang, you draw the path on the screen, and the boomerang hits its targets and comes back based on the path you drew, which is kind of cool. You can interact with the game by blowing on stuff. So let's say, for example, there's two torches that you come across in the game. You blow, and the torches go out. So that was pretty nifty. And overall, I think it's going to be a cool game to take with me on the road. I've got a couple of business trips coming up this year, and it's always nice to have something that you kind of lose yourself in on the plane, especially since one of my trips is going to be to Oregon, which is going to be a heck of a long plane ride.
SFFaudio.com, the sound of tomorrow. Explore the limitless worlds of the imagination with SFFaudio.com. Reviews and features, audiobooks, online audio, full cast audio drama, and radio theater. The ultimate source for news from the world of science fiction and fantasy audio, brought to you by the most trusted team in the business. SFFaudio.com. The future never sounded so good.
So one of the other casualties of NaNoWriMo was my podcast listening time. I didn't go to the gym. I drove to work more often than I should have, and I really just did not have much time to listen to podcasts. They just fell completely to the back burner, and truth be told, that's one of the reasons why I haven't really been doing Radioactive either, because I feed off of the podcasts I listen to. Listening to stuff like Geek Acres or Dice Make Bonk or The Game Master Show makes me want to do my podcast, and when I don't listen to those podcasts, amazingly, I don't want to do my show. So it's funny how that feedback loop gets set up. But now that NaNoWriMo is over, I have been returning to my podcast with a vengeance, and I've been just kind of blowing through my lineup, getting caught up on all the shows that came out back in November and early December. Now, first up, I had the Accidental Survivors podcast, which I've always enjoyed. I enjoy it now even more because I'm running a Mutants and Mastermind superheroes campaign, which is set in the modern day in Green Ronin's Freedom City. So a lot of their advice, which I thought was more... A lot of their advice is about running modern games. And since traditionally I run a fantasy game, you know, it's good stuff to talk about because you can still carry it over to your fantasy game occasionally, but mostly it's focused on, you know, drawing inspiration from headlines and talking specifically about issues relating to running a modern game. But now that I got this superheroes game, it's all the more appropriate. But now the episodes of Accidental Survivors that I've been listening to involve campaign planning, which is pretty cool. They had an episode entirely dedicated to campaign planning, and another one entirely about adventure design, which I haven't launched into the adventure design one yet, but I'm looking forward to it. Both of these come into play... Well, both of these are appropriate right now because the Mutants and Mastermind campaign, or at least Volume 1 of the Mutants and Masterminds campaign, is winding down, and I'm going to be starting up with Aralar, who frequently visits Nuketown. We're going to be starting up a Savage Worlds weird pulp game, which is based on movies like Indiana Jones and the, well, all the Indiana Jones movies, the Mummy movie, Hellboy, certainly heavily influenced by Hellboy. And so we've got this weird pulp kind of World War II-ish kind of game coming up, and we're doing a lot of campaign planning, and we're starting to think about adventure design. So really, it's just all coming together perfectly. Next show I listened to was The Master Plan, which is actually a show I talked about one or two podcasts ago. But this is about game design, and it's very much oriented towards crafting your own games. Now, a lot of, like I said before, a lot of this stuff doesn't necessarily apply to what I'm doing because I'm obviously using somebody else's rule sets. But I'm very interested in rules hacking and tweaking things, and I think a lot of what they talk about in this podcast can really be ported back to a regular game, even if you aren't planning on rebuilding Dungeons & Dragons from the ground up, although you may want to when 4th edition comes out. You'll still find stuff of use in this game. So, for example, one of the things I thought that was really interesting in the latest episode of Master Plan, or maybe one back, is the conversation about the expectations about game masters. Do you need a game master? Do you need more than one game master? What should the role of the game master be? Should the game master be setting up the story? Should the game master be the arbiter? What would a game look like in which everybody's the game master and there's only one player? What would it look like if there were no game masters and basically all the players were taking a part in designing the world and telling the story and all that? So very interesting podcast. It's something that I think people who have been playing D&D for a long time should listen to because it kind of flexes your brain and makes you think about things in a different way. So speaking about thinking about things in a different way, we have the Game Master Show, which the latest episode that I listened to, and there's a whole queue of stuff that I need to listen to for the Game Master Show, but the show that I just listened to was talking about the merit of character versus character conflict and player versus player conflict. What's good, what's bad, what works, what doesn't. And I think it's interesting kind of how they break it down, because it's not just a question of, well, gee, player versus player is bad, we just need to not do that. And some people think that means that, well, character shouldn't have conflict at the table, but gaming and stories, and well, storytelling, right, and games themselves are all about conflict. It's about two or more parties challenging each other for control. So it's not surprising that characters would come into conflict. It's just a question of how do you manage that, and what kind of conflict is good, and what kind of conflict is bad. So another great show to listen to for game masters, and honestly for players. Now, on my more libertarian side, I've been catching up on the Cato Daily podcast, which has some shows about election results in Venezuela, subprime mortgage bailouts, Oprah pitching Barack Obama, and the CAF fuel standards, which may sound like really dry type of thing, but I think the cool thing about the Cato Daily podcast is that they're usually pretty compelling and conversationally presented. So there's a host who interviews usually either a guest for Cato, something like a guest speaker, or an expert at Cato about a given issue. And I think the thing that I like most about it is that it's a perspective that you're not going to necessarily get from mainstream media. They may occasionally offer some of these viewpoints, but it's really rare that you're going to see something like this in Time or Newsweek or the New York Times or the Washington Post or whatever. So I definitely like getting my kind of daily libertarian fix through Cato. And if you are of that leanings, then I would check it out. And if you're not, well, you know, I'd still check it out. Broaden your mind. Now, the other thing that I've been catching up on is the Geek Acres podcast, which has recently been talking about the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles, the Princess Bride DVD. Yes, there's a yet another version of the Princess Bride DVD out. Star Trek Enterprise Putters. Yes, putters as in golf. And a bunch of other stuff. So I feel probably the worst about falling behind on Geek Acres because it's a short podcast. It's really easy to keep up with because the shows are 15 to 20 minutes long, and yet somehow I wasn't able to fit it in during the month of November, but that's okay. I have a whole bunch of episodes to catch up on, which just means I have lots of good listening ahead of me. Now, Dice Make Bonk comes out at an infrequent schedule, which works for me since I end up listening at an infrequent schedule. The latest episode talks about death and resurrection of player characters. And it offers what I think is just a brilliant bit of advice, which is when your character dies in the game, or when you have a player with a character that dies in the game, just stop playing. End the game. Let the dramatic moment just kind of consume everything, and don't spoil it by saying in the next breath, and you're resurrected when you get back to town, or and they cast Ray's dead. Just kind of end it there and decide, you know, well, what does this mean? How is this character going to come back? Should this character come back? If this character comes back, how will this character be changed? And I think that it's a really good topic for fantasy role-playing games, but I think it's probably something you could talk about for pretty much any game. I mean, look at the superhero genre, where you know characters die and come back every other year. I think it's just a really good approach to be able to say, you know, gee, character X just died. Huh. Let's pause and think about that for a minute and have it have more meaning than just, oh, yeah, they died. Start rolling up a new character. So really good podcast. Check it out. It's a topic that I hadn't really thought about before, but now that I have, I got to say, brilliant. It's definitely the way I'd like to go about doing things the next time I kill off a character. Now, rounding out my podcast listening will be the Dungeons & Dragons podcast, which occasionally I cringe when listening to nowadays because it's all about 4th edition, and that can be a good thing, but it can also be a bad thing, as they talk about game design, including rules, characters, monsters, and basically how the new edition is going to work. Now, I rambled on and ranted about D&D 4th edition a while back, and I'm not going to go back into that right now, but suffice it to say, there are a lot of changes coming, and I think if you want to keep up with those changes and you want to have some insight into why they're doing it, how they're doing it, what this may mean for your game come June when these books are finally released, I would definitely listen to the D&D podcast. And if not, well, you can ignore it and just be surprised when June comes.
This woman like bees, Sarge. I don't think we're going to make it.
Damn it, Bukowski. Keep your head together. We're going to win that hill if it's the last thing we do.
Sorry, Sarge. I just don't know what to do.
What? Why not? Did you listen to the Accidental Survivors podcast?
You mean the podcast about modern tabletop role-playing games and related media topics?
Yeah, the one put together by the Swords Edge Publishing guys.
Sorry, Sarge. I didn't.
Sorry I'm late. I was listening to the Accidental Survivors podcast, and then I went and sabotaged the lines.
Logan, you beautiful bastard!
Let's go take that hill, men.
The Accidental Survivors Podcast, a podcast about modern tabletop role-playing systems and related topics. Visit us at the web at accidentalsurvivors.libsyn.com.
Give my daughter a call sometime, Logan.
And that will be about it for this edition of Nuketown Radioactive. Ran a bit long, probably rambled on a lot, made a bunch of mistakes, but you know what? That's okay, because the important thing was to get the podcast back out again. I don't know what the schedule's going to be like. Rattling around in the back of my brain that I want to go back to weekly, because that's the kind of discipline I'd like to impose on myself. But January is going to be a tough month, so we'll see. I think my goal for this month will be to get out one more podcast, probably about mid-month, and then kind of sit back and think what is realistically possible for this podcast and how frequently can it come out. But we'll see. I think the new schedule will probably go into effect in February, which gives me plenty of time to procrastinate about what I want to do. Anyway, I'm always looking for feedback. You can send it to me at nuketown@gmail.com.